Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you all for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Stuart Patrick with us today to discuss the challenges of global governance. Dr. Patrick is CFR Senior Fellow and Director of the International Institutions and Global Governance Program, or what we refer to as IIGG. Previously, he was CFR's International Affairs Fellow. From 2005 to 2008, Dr. Patrick was a research fellow at the Center for Global Development, and before that, he served on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff with lead responsibility for U.S. policy toward Afghanistan. Dr. Patrick is the author of the book, Weak Links, Fragile States, Global Threats, and International Security, and he writes the CFR blog, The Internationalist, which you can access on our homepage. He also tweets at Stuart M. Patrick, if you'd like to follow him. So, Stuart, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your taking the time. It would be great if you could begin by talking, giving us your definition of global governance and explain why it is so critical to all that we do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Irina, and it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to your audience from a number of different universities around the country and indeed around the world. On global governance, you know, it's a slippery term. I think that, a lot of people tend to use it synonymously as world government, but that's not what it is. It actually refers to something far more practical, and that's the collective effort by sovereign states, international organizations, but also increasingly non-state actors, to try to get together to address common challenges and opportunities that transcend national frontiers. So, you know, at the domestic level, governance is pretty straightforward. It's usually provided by governments and in the democratic world, elected governments. At the global level, it's inherently more complex and inherently more fragmentary, but it's still possible. National governments obviously have for centuries been getting together to negotiate certain standards of behavior, and these have gotten increasingly dense, these interactions. So you have countries getting together to negotiate behavior in areas like trade or nuclear weapons, and then they embed these norms and rules into international institutions. But unlike domestic authorities, something that's different about global governance is that most cooperative multilateral bodies, with the possible exception of the UN Security Council, really lack the power to enforce compliance with their decisions. As I said, the landscape of global governance is increasingly fragmented and crowded, and that's both a blessing and a curse. You know, on one hand, it lets a thousand flowers bloom. On the other hand, it can lead to some duplication and redundancy. But if you think about it, you know, you've got universal membership bodies or almost universal membership bodies like the Bretton Woods institutions, you know, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the UN, and its whole labyrinth of agencies. But in alongside those universal institutions, you increasingly have a role for regional and sub-regional actions at the bodies. There's all sorts of multilateral alliances and security arrangements, you know, ranging from NATO to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. You've also got self-selecting clubs, like the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, or the Organization of the Islamic Countries. Increasingly, people in the trade area talk about plurilateral arrangements, such as the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is, you know, a narrower group of countries. And then you've got consultative bodies like the G20 and the G8. So really a welter of different types of frameworks out there. And one of the things that has increasingly occurred is that you're starting to get non-governmental actors and also private sector actors get involved also in some standard setting and regulatory things, partly because they have particular expertise you can draw on. And a good example of this would be the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, which actually includes the Gates Foundation, for instance, on its board. But there are many others we can talk about. You know, the result of this is that global governance is, frankly, sort of an ungodly mess sometimes. It's for those of you who have been to Paris or have seen pictures of the Pompidou Center in Paris, it's sort of similar. It's a building in which you've got all the plumbing, wiring, and load-bearing pillars that are sort of outside, and it looks a little bit messy, but somehow it sometimes works. You know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about today was the degree to which global governance has actually been delivering, and sort of talk to us about some obstacles briefly of also about so first talk about the balance sheet of global governance, and then talk about why global governance reform can be so difficult. And what I'd like to do is maybe spend the next 10 minutes doing that, and then opening up for questions. You know, and I'd like to frame this in the context of the fact that President Obama came to office, you know, having campaigned on a new era of international cooperation, which was going to basically was the premise on the fact that, look, the demand for effective multilateral cooperation is vastly outstripping the supply. And so he said, we're going to reform international institutions, and we're going to bring in new actors and integrate rising powers. So the question is sort of how have things been going? And I think that the balance sheet, you have to say, is sort of mixed at best. Over the past 5 years or so, I think the surprisingly, maybe, that some of the best progress has been made in the global financial sphere. This is, you know, after the worst crisis since the Great Depression. But you've had innovations, the major innovations have occurred, like creating the Group of 20, for instance, or reinvigorating the International Monetary Fund. Obviously, progress is still pretty tentative here, and we can talk about, you know, successes and failures in that realm, but it's probably been the bright spot. Another bright spot, relatively speaking, has been combating transnational terrorism. Now, there's obviously been a lot of criticism, both in this administration and the previous one, about how the United States has sort of gone about conducting its global war on terrorism. But there's really some unsung successes that have been made, including capacity building, intelligence sharing, law enforcement cooperation, and a whole bunch of new treaties and arrangements that have helped things. Obviously, Al-Qaeda, as we saw, and its affiliates remain very, very dangerous. We just saw this in Kenya, but it is, to some degree, at least as a core Al-Qaeda, the shadow of its former self. Turning to nuclear proliferation, here we have a situation where the glass is at best half full, and where there's a growing sense that the nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation regime is really at a tipping point, thanks to North Korean and Iranian defiance in particular. We'll see if the potential deal with Iran pans out. But, you know, especially as nuclear energy spreads, it raises all sorts of proliferation dangers. On when it comes to peacekeeping and peacemaking, both within the United Nations and regional organizations, again, a mixed bag. On the one hand, the incidence of conflict, both intrastate as well as interstate, has declined. But you still see the UN and the African Union often get mandates that they really have lacked the capabilities to actually fulfill. And then, of course, as Syria shows, when you have blockage on the Security Council, you really have no end to the bloodletting. Just a couple more areas that I'll touch on. One of them is on global health. Here it's very interesting. You know, it used to be that the global health arena was dominated by the World Health Organization, but there's been this proliferation of international actors, and including multi-stakeholder arrangements like the Global Alliance on Vaccines and Immunizations. And on the positive side, there's really been a lot of progress made on infectious disease, including HIV/AIDS, but not limited to that. On the downside, the world is only beginning to grapple with the problem of non-communicable diseases, things like obesity, heart disease, sort of afflictions of the wealthy West, we used to think, but actually ones that are spreading very quickly into the developing world, so that, for instance, obesity in Mexico right now is actually higher than it is in the United States. But the biggest failure, I would say, with multilateral cooperation or global governance has been really in the area of climate change. And here, you know, the Earth is really facing a potential planetary catastrophe, according to the latest projections for how high average temperatures in, are going to rise. And yet so far, partly because of the failure of the U.S. to pass domestic legislation, but also because of the failure of the major emerging economies, not least China, to agree to binding limitations, you really have major problems. There are other issues that I can talk about with respect to technological change and the need to deal with global governance on that, but perhaps in the interest of time, I'll shift now to the question of what makes global governance reform so tough. And there are several points that I'll make here, and also sort of exploring whether or not there are ways around these blockages. The first point I'd make is that it takes a crisis. And I think for major institutional reform to occur, and this is true often domestically as well as internationally, things generally need to get worse before they get better. Because in normal times, you have incredible institutional inertia. The power wielders have vested interest in keeping things the same. And so this can stymie the best intended reformers. When you have catastrophic policy failure, you do tend to get change. And so it's no accident that the major global institutional, the great sort of golden era of global institution building was in the aftermath of the Great Depression and the Second World War. You had something similar, albeit on a smaller scale, after the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the collapse of the subprime mortgage market and the freezing basically of the global financial system. In the aftermath of that, I think leaders stared into the abyss and they said, we really have to do something about this. The second point I would say is that the devil you know is often better than the devil you don't. When you look at global governance, one of the most egregious failures has been the failure to reform the composition of the Security Council, and particularly the permanent membership of that body, which hasn't changed since 1945. And it's interesting, the Obama administration has rhetorically said, we're in favor of change, we're in favor even of India taking its eventual seat as a permanent member, but it hasn't followed up at all. And the reason that it hasn't followed up at all, I think, is really twofold. One is there's a lack of confidence that a large Security Council, particularly if it was too big, would actually make things any better. And then the other thing is that there's a real question as to whether or not the potential, the most sort of likely aspirants for permanent membership, whether it's Brazil or India or even Japan and Germany, would actually behave in ways or take positions that would help the United States. This is also true of South Africa. In particular, the sort of large emerging country democracies, you'd think on the one hand, their democracies, they should line up with the United States, but experience has suggested that there are other ideological barriers to cooperation. And then there's finally the question of whether or not the United States could possibly bring this about. A few more issues of why global governance reform perhaps in this case, whether there are any other options besides when global governance reform is blocked. The point I would make here, and this is my third point, is that we live in what I call a GX world. Now, thanks to Ian Bremmer and David Gordon of the Eurasia Foundation, it's been commonplace to say that, hey, we live in a G0 world. And that implies that every nation's out for itself, international cooperation is almost impossible. But I think that's a caricature. I think what's really amazing when you look at the world is the rich tapestry of multilateral cooperation that actually exists. And what this means is that the United States has an opportunity for forum shopping. You can work with the GX. The X is you can change that number, right? So you can work with the G7 if you want to work with your Western allies on global financial cooperation. You can work with the G8 if it's important to have Russia there, but still keep it largely Western. Or if you want to get all of the major emerging countries too, then you work through the G20. So there are different frameworks, and that provides some fluidity and flexibility to the United States. The fourth point is that a lot of people have talked about the BRICS, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as really a new bloc on the international stage and potentially a power center. But the point I would make is that the BRICS don't have a lot of mortar binding them or holding them together, if you will. It's a catchy acronym, but it ignores that there's more, at least as much as divides these countries as unites them. So I think one has to be careful with that. A fifth point I would make is that I think when it comes to global governance, it's become clear that the era of UN mega conferences is largely over. Yes, we're going to still see the 193-odd member countries of the UN get together regularly and meet around the world to address big problems like climate change, et cetera. But I think it's become clear through these annual conference of parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change that the notion that you can negotiate a complex treaty, soup to nuts treaty, you know, with 193 members is just really a mirage. The same, I think, is also increasingly true in trade negotiations, which is why you've seen the WTO Doha round be so stymied. And I know that WTO trade ministers are meeting in Bali in a couple of months to try to rescue or salvage Doha, but I think that the reality is that we're going to be moving towards a more fragmented approach to trade negotiations, which is too bad, but maybe the only way forward. Just two more points. One of them is that, you know, I've talked a little bit about ad hoc coalitions and mini-lateral networks. In other words, sort of smaller groups getting together. And these are smaller groups of the capable and like-minded. But there's – and those that share common interests. But there's also another phenomenon going on, and that's the rise of the regions. And you're increasingly getting dynamic regional and sub-regional organizations – sometimes as complements, but sometimes as competitors to universal membership organizations like the United Nations. And so you think of ASEAN, for instance, in Southeast Asia, or the African Union, which is taking on a much bigger role in peace and security. Sometimes it, you know, its objectives are unrealistic, but it is becoming more of an actor on the African continent. And you see the rise of hybrid, for instance, peace missions between the United Nations and the African Union. Now, the last point I'll make is that global governance is increasingly desperately needed when it comes to governing the global commons. And by global commons, I mean those physical spaces, or in some cases virtual spaces, that no nation controls, but which all rely on for their security and prosperity. And the most important of the global commons are the maritime domain, that is the oceans, outer space, and cyberspace. And because all three of them serve, in a sense, as a collective tissue of globalization. Now, the United States for a long time has dominated or has been the prime mover and had first mover advantages in all of these areas. But increasingly, these areas are becoming congested, contested, and competitive, with different countries having different ideas about how they should be governed. And so one of the big questions for the United States is how do you actually integrate countries like China, Russia, India, Brazil, and others into a common set of rules? And so I would just finish with that. And I realize that's a very long laundry list of both observations of where we are and what the challenges are and obstacles to global governance reform. But I hope it provides some food for interesting discussion and questions. So I'd now like to turn it back to the participants.
Great. Thanks so much, Stuart. I think it gives us a good basis for this conversation that we're about to have. So let's open up now to the students on the call.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from University of Tuskegee.
Oh, wow. Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, no, yes, I can hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
Perfect. Actually, I just want to tie this one into a book that I have assigned for my class, Foreign Policy Begins at Home. In the regular idea that sometimes it takes a alien invasion, literally, to garner enough cooperation to do the big things. And on that level, how would you grade, actually, in a comparative fashion, the actions taken after the meltdown of 2008 compared to the ones in the 30s?
It's a very interesting question. It's actually the subject of a working paper, or at least part of the subject of a working paper that Dan Dresner, who you may be familiar with, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University, wrote for us working paper for the council, which was called The Irony of Global Economic Governance, The System Worked. And in it, he actually compares the response in from 2008 to 2011 in particular, compared to that from 1929 to, say, 1933. And he shows that the performance, even though the initial conditions were not all that different, that the performance was much better this time. There were, and I'll just mention two or three. One of them was that the countries of the world got together and injected incredible amounts of liquidity into the global economic system, particularly at the London summit of April 2009. They also formed a multilateral, rather than sort of going their own way, they formed a new multilateral institution, consultative group, the G20, by elevating the pre-existing G20 finance ministers. They were lucky to already have existing institutions, but they didn't ignore them. They actually ramped them up, so they increased the funds and the mandate of the International Monetary Fund. And probably most important, compared to the 1930s, they didn't engage in tit-for-tat protectionism and sort of beggar-thy-neighbor policies. What they did instead was proclaimed a number of standstill arrangements. In other words, you weren't allowed to add new protectionist and discriminatory measures. And they, by and large, stuck with that. Protectionism has been one of the dogs that didn't bark, but it's a very good question.
To follow up to that question, why is there bifurcation in the global governance system despite the attempts of the ideal to form this multilateral arrangement?
So there are a number of different fissures in world politics right now. I think that one of the most important fissures is really this bifurcation in the attitudes of the established, largely Western, or you could call them Northern as well, but Western advanced market democracies on the one hand, who have been responsible for lots of the rules of the game to date, and rising powers, and this is something that does unite the BRICS, rising powers, emerging powers, who believe that the current game is stacked against them. Now, you're not getting a sort of full frontal assault on the existing order, but what you are getting is a demand that authority and influence and voice within these organizations get reallocated. And there's been some effort to do that, but it's gone much slower than you might like, than one might like. In the case of the International Monetary Fund, for instance, in 2010 there was an agreement to alter the chairs and shares, that is, the chairs on the executive board, and also the quota shares, which determines the voting weight of each of the countries, so that it would benefit China and other emerging economies, even though it was less than what many people wanted. But partly as a result of the failure of the U.S. Congress to actually act on that legislation, even though it's revenue neutral, it's really at a standstill. And the more these institutions don't reflect the world as it is, the more they court a legitimacy crisis. I should also say that there are also particular differences between the United States and Western countries and some of the emerging countries that have different regime types. And some of the disputes, for instance, over cybersecurity and internet governance have been between countries that are essentially closed countries and authoritarian or semi-authoritarian like China and Russia, which would like to control the content of the information that gets to their citizens versus those that favor a more open approach, including the United States and its Western European allies.
I'm pleased to hear that you've assigned Richard Haass's, the President of the Council on Foreign Relations, book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home. That's terrific. Stuart, we'll go on to the next question then.
Super.
Next question comes from Maxwell at Syracuse University.
Yes, this is Francine D'Amico, and my question is, what's your yardstick for measuring success on the CFR report cards on global governance? Is it structural reform? Is it functional change? Or is it how well global governance institutions serve U.S. national interests?
That's a very good question, and always a tricky one to think about metrics. I think it's less, normally when CFR does things, it tends to take a U.S. National interest lens in things, probably because we are a U.S. membership organization. In this case, we took a broader yardstick to look at basically what efforts have been made to actually deal with the problem as it is with a global interest in mind. Now, when we grade the international community and specific actors, well, we grade the international community. That's what the grade is for. But we also then grade the United States' efforts. So, you know, we will take the United States to task if, in our view and the view of the many experts that we consulted and sort of crowdsourced the document from, the U.S. has dropped the ball, for instance, in climate change, the failure to pass domestic legislation. It got some penalties for that, but on the other hand, it got some credit for the fact that the United States had implemented at least higher fuel efficiency standards. So it's you know, we grade the United States and we grade the international community, but it's less about advancing U.S. national interest than in addressing what we define to be the problem, and also the degree to which we also look at different institutions and the actors and call them leaders and laggards or truants, and we basically use our report card almost as if it were, you know, something you might have gotten in fifth grade, and so in making those designations, you know, we make a judgment as to whether or not they're helping or hindering the problem.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from the Clinton Institute for American Studies.
Hello?
That was from the Clinton Institute.
Thank you. I'm wondering, given the importance of organizations in global governance, where do you see the future for elected representatives and governments?
I think that's a very interesting question. One of the issues and frequent criticisms, if I get your question right, and one of the frequent criticisms of international organizations is this question of democratic accountability. It's obviously been a huge issue within the European Union, where people talk about a democracy deficit because while governments have a place at the table, there's been a question of, as to, in a sense, you know, national governments obviously have been elected in the case of European countries by their own citizens, but the question then is who's actually holding international organizations accountable? Is it only sort of the national level officials, or is there a way to give citizens a role? And so that there have been efforts to try to increase, for instance, the role of the European Parliament as, in a sense, as a watchdog on the European Union and the European project. And I think there's been some dissatisfaction with how much of a voice citizens have. You know, in general, this is an active debate, the degree to which as the world gets more integrated and states join intergovernmental organizations, to what degree should national prerogatives be either compromised or surrendered different authorities? That includes I think, you know, under U.S. law, under U.S. Constitutional law, there are active questions that persist over the degree to which, you know, international treaties, for instance, should be self-executing versus non-self-executing. And there are continual concerns over, for instance, with respect to the United Nations, about whether their methods are transparent enough and accountable enough. So the United States has traditionally pushed for, tried to get some of this accountability, has tried to push for, you know, inspectors general that are actually independent of the organization, et cetera, because I think there is a genuine fear, and it's not entirely misplaced, that sometimes international organizations will take on a life of their own and or conceivably pursue agendas that were not in their original mandate. But it's a very interesting question.
Thank you. Next question.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Our next question comes from San Diego State University.
Hello, good morning. My question is, if we're looking through a U.S. lens at global common best practices, shouldn't we focus strongly on international law and make it more solidified, especially from a U.S. position as we move into the post-Washington consensus? And I was also wondering how you think about the speed that law moves, and do we need to change that to accommodate new technology as we're dealing with things like space, as you said, and drones as well? And I was interested in Fareed Zakaria's recent reporting about using mobile courts in Pakistan so that, and possibly in Afghanistan, so that the Taliban isn't deciding disputes in tribal areas.
Those are very interesting questions. I mean, I think one of the things that I was going to mention, you mentioned technology, and I think that one of the issues is there has been this furious pace of technological change. Technology is always to some degree driven driven rulemaking, or at least posed a challenge to existing rules. You think of, for instance, just the move to standard time, about a little over a century ago. You know, in the past there were sort of an infinite number of different time zones. Now there are 24 recognized time zones around the world, and the reason for the move to standard time was because you needed to have a harmonization of frankly, railroad schedules, so you knew when a train was arriving and when it was departing, and also steamship schedules. And so those technology has long been a driver of sort of global governance arrangements. There are a number of ones that have come up. You mentioned drones. In addition to the rules about targeted killings, there's a lot of continuing dispute over what those rules should be, and particularly as other players, not just the United States, come in on the line with drones, what are going to be the rules there? Other ones are, there's really no legal framework for synthetic biology as well, the creation of novel genetic material, which can often have a lot of therapeutic use, but it can also be used conceivably to endanger biosecurity or create, super designer bugs that could kill many people. Another whole area is nanotechnology. There's no rules there necessarily. And also another one is geoengineering. The effort to try to manipulate the Earth's climate system so that perhaps we would suffer less from global warming. But again, you could imagine that freelance efforts in those directions could lead to a lot of Dr. Strangelove outcomes. So yes, there is a need driven by technology to create new forms of new rules and norms and perhaps binding law in these areas. Now, you mentioned, when it comes to the global commons, I think you're probably right that, the United States as the first mover probably has a national interest in trying to come up with a set of rules or to codify a set of rules that others can in principle live with rather than challenge, because that would, in a sense, probably from a narrow U.S. national interest perspective, continue to augment U.S. superiority even as our sort of relative power might diminish or others might rise. I've looked at the global commons, including cyberspace, ocean space, and outer space, and there are some significant problems with creating international treaties in each of those areas, which doesn't mean they shouldn't be pursued, but in some cases you may have to disaggregate the problem. It would be very difficult to have, according to my colleague Adam Siegel at the Council on Foreign Relations, very difficult to actually have a single treaty governing cyberspace. One could imagine a treaty or breaking the problem apart into the issues of cybercrime, internet governance, and the laws of cyber war, but to have one treaty that would deal with all might be very difficult. In terms of conduct on the oceans, you know, the United States would be in a far better position if it actually ratified the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which has been pending for quite some time and has been endorsed by virtually every U.S. president, every Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, but the U.S. still has not done so. In the meantime, you know, codes of conduct, for instance, in the South China Sea could be a meaningful way to try to deal with that. But it's a very interesting issue as to whether you should go for binding law or, in a sense, sort of softer norms.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from University of Pennsylvania.
Hi. So the CSR report is, in general, very positive in regard to the global response to the 2008 financial crisis, but it's less positive in terms of the reform of financial institutions. So I'm wondering what you think the role of global governance is in regard to changing the regulations on what are often domestic financial institutions.
Yeah, it's it is a real quandary when it comes to global financial regulation. The reality is that there is often little you can do in terms of commanding harmonization of national financial standards. And to some degree, you probably have to leave what you want to avoid is obviously regulatory arbitrage, right, where some countries have very high financial standards and others have low ones, or a couple have low ones, and so therefore those firms that don't want to be regulated all hightail it to the low standard venue or location. What you want to do is you want to have them be, in a sense, equally tough, but because different countries have different financial systems and also because they're sometimes at different levels of development, they probably can't be identical, and as a practical matter, there's no way to ensure that they are identical because it has to work through national legislation, whether it's Dodd-Frank in this country or its equivalents abroad. With respect to so there is a very difficult, you know, navigating that domestic international frontier is extremely difficult and tricky when it comes to financial regulation. You know, when it comes to international institutional reform, I think, you know, despite the fact that the G20 was created, and despite the fact that there is a financial stability board that was created, those are good things. There are still some questions about implementation and time lags, and a worry that some of these institutions will be subject to what is known as regulatory capture, where the very industries, particularly a very powerful financial industry, which is supposed to be regulated, might actually end up being less regulated because some of the regulators, you know, have too cozy relationships with the members of that industry, or indeed come from that industry. And so the question is, who's looking out necessarily for sort of the average citizen, if you will? One of the breakthroughs was so-called Basel III capital requirement standards for banks, which, you know, sailed through rather quickly in sort of global negotiation terms. But again, there's a sort of a 7 or 8 year window in which those new regulations can be implemented. And, you know, there's a fear that, you know, as people will take their eye off the ball, that some of these things will never be fully implemented. So you need to have strong oversight and a watchdog role at the international level. And as I already mentioned, when it came to international reform of the International Monetary Fund, you know, there still is a lot of follow through that needs to go, that needs to occur for the agreements that were made in 2010 to actually be realized.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from University of Houston.
Good afternoon. I had a question on Afghanistan and also about U.S. foreign policy. So the situation in Afghanistan is uncertain. the public is concerned that the situation will get worse after 2014 when the U.S. forces withdraw. The Afghan government has been marked as a failed state. So the question is, what major challenges might face the international community after 2014, and what will be the U.S. role as a global leader state in Afghanistan? And the second question was concerned with U.S. foreign policy, that is, what is the importance of societal factors, and how much is the impact of societal factors, such as public opinion, media, and such, on U.S. foreign policy and its impact on global leadership of the United States?
Thank you very much. Rather complex questions. With respect to Afghanistan, I think that the United States obviously has been engaged and as both in Operation Enduring Freedom and on the sort of less military side of things in terms of reconstruction and rebuilding of that country, along with many, many international partners, not least the United Nations, obviously since late 2001, after the invasion of Afghanistan and the toppling of the Taliban government. Obviously, the security situation will continue to be extremely tenuous. The Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police are better than they used to be, but still, particularly the police, rather afflicted by corruption. A lot of what occurs will depend on the ongoing efforts to try to bring reconciliation between the Taliban and the Afghan government in Kabul, including President Hamid Karzai and his successor. What will be the issues? The issues will be partly how can the Afghan army, which has been so reliant on external financial support, actually sustain itself, and how will the international community or the United States and its partners, will they continue to support an army and an armed forces which the Afghan government has no revenue to actually support on its own, regardless of the professionalism of that force. Another issue and quandary that will arise is what happens if there are, particularly if there are major more inroads by the Taliban, even simply if it's influence of warlords, how can universal human rights principles possibly promoted in that country, including the rights of women and girls? And I think that that could pose some major dilemmas. The United States will be tempted simply to have a very small footprint and to simply only get involved in security when it relates to safe havens for terrorism. But the question is, will certain, whether humanitarian or other situations arise where there will be a groundswell of support to do more? I suspect not, given how fatigued people in the United States are. And that gets to your second question. I think that I still am reluctant to call it isolationism, but there's no question that there's, and this came out in polling with respect to Syria, that public opinion matters. Leaders listen to public opinion, and the fact that there was such a groundswell of opposition to the prospect of the use of force in Syria led the president to, in a sense, back off and look to go to Congress before the Russian initiative changed the diplomacy. So it exercises, I think, public opinion. You can lead public opinion, and I think that there are times when real leadership involves listening to public opinion but not necessarily being led by the nose by public opinion, because public opinion can be changed if one looks at the record of, say, Franklin Roosevelt in the, prior to U.S. entry into the Second World War.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from Columbia University.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for your talk. It's you probably know it's the UN General Assembly this week, and I heard Gordon Brown talk about many of the issues that you brought up and the global governance, and he noted something that was even on a practical term, so about the G20. It's great to have these groups, but who governs them? Like, there's no secretariat for the G20. No one's taking minutes. No one's, you know. So I'm wondering how you would go about, you know, selecting even a secretariat, or and is there even good models or framework that's already been done that could be replicated?
Great question. There's a Gordon Brown who has been really at the forefront as a leader when he was prime minister, and then afterwards in thinking about potential new models of global governance and how one arranges the world to try to handle some of these intractable or seemingly extraordinarily complex global issues. The G20, just in terms of its performance, did very well when it was a crisis committee for the global economy. You know, it just like a hanging, it sort of concentrated the mind. The other way I've described it is that, you know, when they were all in a lifeboat and the storm was really tossing them, they were all pulling in the same direction on the oars. But once you started getting this uneven, some would say three-speed recovery, with different countries moving out of it at different paces, then national interests began to resurrect themselves. And so you've had this sort of sense that the G20 is not really living up to its potential, and that was reinforced by the sort of desultory summit in St. Petersburg, which really only made headlines because of the Syria issue. The question of whether or not the G20 should have a secretariat and how transparent it should be and whether or not it should become a real institution as opposed to a consultative mechanism continues to be a subject of debate. You know, there are debates. There's a trade-off between effectiveness and representativeness, as you know, or can be. And a lot of people have said, well, the G20 may be effective, but it's not really legitimate because it's not representative of the rest of the world, although it does represent about 85% of the world's GDP, and obviously the major economies and much of about two-thirds of the world's population. Some have said that there should be, you know, it should be expanded, there should be greater outreach, but also others have said there needs to be, for institutional learning and for sort of cumulative just performance, good performance, there needs to be a secretariat. Most governments have resisted that because they're a little bit worried about the sorcerer's apprentice phenomenon, where institutions that get a secretary, then the secretary takes on a life of its own, pursues its own agenda. And I think most governments, including the United States, still want to avoid that. What they've tried to do instead is to have what they call a troika system, where you have the previous host, the current host, and the future host, the three governments, collaborate and interact with one another and perhaps even second staff to one another. It has not worked particularly well. I think that in part because the country that actually has the chair at any one time doesn't really want to share very well. They don't want to be influenced in terms of their priorities by the others. I think you could have something like a virtual secretariat where, you know, internet-based in a sense, rather than having one where you necessarily had to have, an actual physical place where that was staffed by members of the different G20 governments. But, again, many people still would favor a secretariat role. I also should note that although the summits only happen once a year, there is an incredible latticework of working groups at the sort of mid-level that takes place throughout the entire year. So there's huge amounts of, if not paper flow, then electron flow going around from capitals to capitals already. You know, managing that process, whether through troika or secretariat, is a very big job.
Thank you. Next question.
The next question comes from Washington University School of Law.
So, moving forward, what, if anything, does IIGB plan to do to increase the number of entities who are in the Gold Star category? And how do you believe that the public should best encourage reforms in global governance?
Could you repeat the first part of that? How does IIGG plan to increase the
number of entities that are in the Gold Star category? And the
oh, right.
The second part of my question was just how you believe the public can best encourage reforms in global governance.
Right. You know, our hope, I mean, I should say that although it would be my that one of the happier days of my life if the head of an organization said we took the following reforms because the International Institutions and Global Governance Program at the Council on Foreign Relations asked us to. One has to be realistic about the potential impact that simply a report card like ours can have. Although we have had some interactions with on the basis of our report card with different international institutions as follow-up, either to try to correct what they consider to be our mistakes, or to try to say, okay, we have, you know, we can do better now going forward. I think partly what we do at the council is to simply to try to call attention to places where these entities have fallen short, but also less so in the report cards themselves, but in the background papers, which accompany them, because there's sort of an annex for each one of them that's probably only about 6 or 7 pages long, to try to provide concrete recommendations for how they could actually move in a more productive direction. For instance, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, for instance, there were a couple of Inspector General's reports found that the Global Fund had really dropped the ball in the way that it had done a couple of its grants to other countries, and there were some allegations of corruption, less in the Global Fund, but within those countries, and in maybe countries that God grants shouldn't have, et cetera. And there was a lot of house cleaning that went on there, and I think, you know, we would certainly reflect the important reforms that had taken place in the next go round. On the question of what the public can do, that's it's hard in this day and age. Publics have tended to be particularly during the financial crisis and the recession, tend to be quite inward looking. But I think increasingly, as it becomes obvious how interlinked the fates of the national publics are to what's going on internationally, I think that you will begin to see greater lobbying campaigns and action by advocacy groups to basically insist on that their governments call for better performance within these groups. I'll give one example. We recently engaged with members of the Food and Drug Administration because a challenge that they have is regulating medicines around the world, and the fact of the matter is that a lot of food, a huge percent of the medicines that come into the United States now, or that we consume, are not domestically produced. They actually are produced in other countries, and so it provides this huge regulatory problem. And it's incumbent, I think, not just upon that agency, but also members of the public to basically alert their Congress people that, look, these national regulatory agencies really need help, and they need to be able to form partnerships with their counterparts abroad, and they probably need greater resources to do that so that our health and safety can be preserved. But that's just one example of how the public could conceivably play a role.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Pitzer College.
Hello. Thank you very much for your talk. My question probably is requesting you to reflect on what the future really bodes for us. And that is, we are assuming that the same economic system is going to be the one the world is going to subscribe to. If you remember, at least before the collapse of the Soviet model, there was that alternative. Do you think that what you are assuming is the same economic system that is going to prevail in order to bring about the effectiveness of this global governance?
It's a very interesting question. It's always dangerous to assume that just because your system has been the one that's been prevailing for quite some time that you're not about to face another crisis. I think that there was a great amount of complacency within the advanced market democracies, for instance, prior prior to the global financial crisis, you know, there was a lot of sort of, I think, superiority on the part of many people in the West when the Asian financial crisis hit in the 1990s, and a suggestion, well, that could never happen here. So I think one has to be on one's guard and have the proper regulatory frameworks in place. That being said, I would say, you know, in terms of the system of global capitalism, my sense is that there probably isn't a major rival on the horizon for that that can produce the kind of growth that capitalism is capable of, and the capital system and the global economy is capable of producing. What I do think will increasingly be on the agenda of governments and certainly publics, to get back to the previous question as well, is the question of growing inequality, not only between different countries, but perhaps more importantly within countries, extraordinary levels of inequality. And I think that one could imagine seeing a major reform movement both within countries but also transnationally to try to insist on a more level playing field and a globalization that has a human face that works for everyone.
Very good.
Thanks. I think if we have time for I think we're at the end of our time. Unfortunately, it's 1 o'clock, so I apologize to all of you on the call who wanted to ask questions. But I do encourage you to take advantage of our Ask CFR experts. You can submit questions online, and experts such as Stuart and others in our studies department will answer them. So that is an avenue open to you. Stuart, thank you very much for your insights today. We really appreciate it. I think you gave us a good understanding of the issues at play vis-a-vis global governance. So thank you.
Well, it's my great pleasure, and it's really wonderful to hear such intelligent questions.
To all of you, just as a reminder, you can follow Stuart Patrick on Twitter at Stuart M. Patrick, and find more of his work by visiting the blog that he keeps up. It's called The Internationalist, and it's on the CFR homepage. Our next call will be on Wednesday, October 9th, with Rachel Vogelstein. She's CFR's Fellow for Women in Foreign Policy, and we'll look at U.S. foreign policy and the rights of women and girls. You can also follow us on Twitter at CFR_academic for information on new CFR resources and upcoming events. And just for all of you, we have launched a new dedicated students page. You have information on these calls and events. Other materials that are suited for researching those term papers that you might have to be doing later on this semester. And we will be highlighting every week a student who is using our materials for your research and for their research and classes. So please write us to let us know what you're doing at educators@cfr.org. So thank you all, and thank you, Stuart Patrick.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.